I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with a rancher who says he's doing the best thing possible for American meat eaters by sending the offspring of cloned prize cattle to market. If you eat meat, do you think you should be informed if it's cloned? But first, FBI agents investigating the shooting of Iraqi civilians by Blackwater security guards last September 16th had reportedly concluded that the deaths of at least 14 of the 17 civilians that day in a Baghdad traffic circle were unjustified, and no evidence was found to back up Blackwater's claim their guards were fired upon. The New York Times broke the story. With us on the line, David Johnston, who co-reported it. David, first of all, do we know... Did all of the Blackwater guards open fire? Did some shoot more than others that day?
That's not clear to us. Our reporting suggested that as many as five of the Blackwater guards fired their weapons. How many Blackwater guards were actually on the scene is still not exactly clearly determined. The investigators have not found evidence to support Blackwater's contention that the Blackwater gunfire was provoked by Iraqi civilians shooting at them.
And yet, investigators reportedly told you that they found that three of the Iraqi civilians who were killed, those deaths may have been justified.
Justified in terms of the exercise of the deadly force policy, which says... you cannot fire at someone unless you believe your life or the life of someone else is in danger. This Blackwater group was a heavily armored convoy of several vehicles that was coming to secure a traffic circle, believing that they had to create a corridor for yet another Blackwater convoy to make its way through the city. Traffic was stopped, and in this case, a white Kia rolled toward the intersection, and a woman and her son, who were in this Kia, were killed. There is some sense that Blackwater may be able to assert that these fell within the deadly force policy, although clearly there are others who would say that even these killings were inappropriate.
Well, at the time, we were reminded that in Iraq, a raised palm means welcome, whereas Americans used it to mean stop. There was confusion about, whether or not they understood that they were being told to stop. Do you know if there's going to be anything in the report about that confusion?
I think there's going to be a lot about the confusion and chaos. What we certainly have heard about is that the FBI had a difficult time trying to piece together the story. Blackwater guards did not cooperate with the FBI investigation. They'd been interviewed in a previous State Department investigation on the condition that their statements wouldn't be used in a criminal investigation. The FBI also had difficulty collecting forensic evidence, but nevertheless, they feel comfortable, I believe, with what their overall findings are turning out to be.
That at least 14 of the deaths that day were unjustified and no evidence was found that the guards were fired upon. Well, meanwhile, the Iraqi government already concluded that the shootings were unprovoked, and a separate U.S. military review found that all of the killings were unjustified. But you write that new Attorney General Michael Mukasey might decide not to prosecute. Why?
The problem here is that there's not a clear statute that covers the activity of the security contractors. There is a law that allows the prosecution of Defense Department contractors operating overseas, but not State Department contractors like Blackwater. There are prosecutors who are pessimistic about the possibility that they'll be able to hold anyone accountable here. That is part of the reason why there have been a number of calls and proposals in Congress for statutory changes that would allow the prosecution of incidents like this.
David Johnston, correspondent for The New York Times. David, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to spend some time today on an issue many of you may think is still in the future, but it's happening right now. Cloned animals and their offspring are making their way to market and perhaps your dinner plate. Last year, the FDA said that meat and milk from cloned animals was safe, but asked ranchers to hold off on selling cloned byproducts until the agency came up with a formal policy. Well, the policy still hasn't come, and some ranchers who, based on the FDA's initial reports, banked their business on the new science, are fed up with waiting. They've already sold the offspring of clones on the open market. They say they're just trying to meet America's demand for meat. Ben Painter of Wired Magazine investigated cloning in this month's issue. He sampled milk, pork, and beef from clone animals and their offspring. And along the way, he met ranchers like Don Coover. Don has raised cloned cattle and their offspring in Galesburg, Kansas. He's also a veterinarian and owns an animal breeding business called SEK Genetics. And he joins us now in the studio. Don, welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
So I'm reading the Wired article, and there you are, about halfway through telling the reporter, what, that you've already sent some cloned animals to market.
I haven't sent cloned animals to market, but I have sent the offspring of cloned animals to market.
Now, some people would say there's no difference because they came from cloned animals.
And some people would say there is no difference between cloned animals and naturally produced animals or conventionally produced animals.
And that would be you. Let's make clear.
That would be almost every scientist that studied the issue. And when the government first put out their request that clones, the offspring of clones, and the products of those offspring or those clones be kept out of the food chain, we honored that request because the federal government said that they were doing a risk assessment analysis. And when it was completed, then they would be able to decide whether this was a suitable product to be on America's dinner plates or not. And everybody that I'm aware of honored that request. After the risk assessment analysis was published, in which the government said there is no health concern, they said that it's safe, wholesome, and nutritious. And they also said a decision will be forthcoming in a few months.
In fact, at the same time, they said to you ranchers, I'm sort of paraphrasing, you can go ahead and eat it. You can milk the cows.
You can raise them.
You can raise them. It's as safe as conventionally raised beef, but we'd rather that you didn't sell it yet because we're not coming out with our full ruling yet. So they told you to go ahead and eat it.
And they said we could go ahead and sell those genetics, and we did.
That would seem to be a conflicting message from the FDA if they're telling you that you can eat this meat byproduct.
I would say that
it, the public.
Basically, the FDA shrank from their responsibility to make a decision which they felt may be controversial in some sectors.
You
some
think
areas.
It's political?
I'm sure it's political.
Well, but as far as sending the offspring into the market, you know, going ahead and saying, you know what, you told me I could eat it, so I'm going to send it into the market too. Don't you think people should know, though? Don't you think that it should be labeled as meat from cloned animals?
The government doesn't think so, and they're the people who require labeling issues.
Well, they haven't decided yet.
They have decided that they won't decide. I don't believe, though, that it's probably fair to require the industry to try to track animals which you basically can't distinguish, not basically, you actually can't distinguish on any level whether they are the result of somatic cell nuclear transfer clones or their offspring or not.
How exactly do you clone an animal?
A somatic cell nuclear transfer clone is an animal that's basically an exact genetic copy of an already naturally produced and occurring animal.
Scientists extract a nucleus from that animal. It contains the genetic material. They insert that into an egg that's missing a nucleus.
That they've removed a nucleus from, yes.
The egg is develops into an embryo with the exact genetic program, and the embryo is implanted into the womb of a surrogate animal.
Exactly.
But why is cloning so valuable? I mean, why does it help the rancher to do it?
If you have an animal that has demonstrated itself to be a superior individual in terms of its production or its performance, and you've spent years or decades, maybe a lifetime, developing those kinds of genetics, and you finally got it right. I mean, if you've got the Seattle slew of the cattle world, it's a shame to lose those genetics in a few years. And, of course, nobody gets out of this alive. This is like the Alamo. Everybody's going to die eventually. Animals are certainly no exception. If you have the ability to extend and preserve those genetics, it seems senseless not to.
It costs about, we understand, $1,500 to raise a naturally conceived cow to breeding age. We understand, though, it costs about $17,000 to clone a cow. So
sure.
It seems more expensive to make the clone.
It is, but you have to take a look at the ability to magnify the impact of those genetics. I sell semen on bulls, beef cattle, bulls, and I do this for a wide variety of bull owners all over the United States. Some of these animals will sell 10, 15, or even 20,000 units of semen in a year. That semen can will be priced between $15 and $30. So let's say you've got a superstar bull that's selling 20,000 units of semen a year at $20 a unit. That's $400,000 or $500,000. $15,000 or $20,000 investment in reproducing those genetics so you can continue to do that year after year is easy math.
Yeah, and with the heifer that you're raising from scratch, you have no idea.
Exactly.
How much milk that cow is going to produce. Well, okay, let's get back to some of the questions now that we understand you know, why this is appealing. For instance, questions about the health of these animals. Dave Schubert, a cell biologist at the Salk Institute in California, told Wired that a herd of clones, for instance, or clones' offspring, could produce some health problems in the herd because they lose their genetic diversity. They'd all be prey, let's say, to the same infection or the same virus. And then we also read about sudden death syndrome, that genes from adults manifest health problems too early in the clones. There was a story in the article about a whole litter of pigs dying from the same adult ulcers. And so there's questions about, you know, how cloning impacts the animals themselves. But then, you know, people also wonder if there's too many cloned animals, if it starts to take over, then the fact that these animals might die sooner is going to endanger the food supply.
I think that if you take a look at biodiversity, which is one of the arguments made against the idea that cloning could or should become widespread, if you take a look at the way animal agriculture has been conducted over the last several thousand years, actually, people have been breeding purebred animals for years and years and years, hundreds of years, and it's going to continue. I would suggest that the ability to genetically store cell lines gives you the ability to maintain genetic diversity down the road. Long story short is, the argument that cloning is going to adversely impact biodiversity, it's a false argument because we're doing that already because of the way we produce animals.
But you don't worry that there's already offspring from clones out in the market. Nobody has any idea, you know, where they went. And there's no tracking of it. And who knows?
I don't worry about that because it's been happening for thousands of years. SCNT, or
genetically modified for thousands of years? Or
crossbreeding and hybridization. Yeah. Depending upon your definition, you can certainly make the argument that hybridization of plants is crossbreeding, or it's genetic.
Nature did it.
Yes.
Nature did it.
Okay, and so it's interesting to me that advanced reproductive technologies have been around for literally thousands of years. And as the technology becomes more advanced and more capable, people start to get, I would say, alarmed at the idea they don't understand what's going on. So, I mean, thousands of years ago, people started breeding the fastest animal to the fastest animal to get another, hopefully faster animal. And then we start hand mating animals, putting a bull in with a group of cows and keeping him away from other cows because they want to promote his genetics with this set of cows.
Right.
And then we start doing artificial insemination in the 40s and 50s.
So you think this is just the next step? Cloning is just the next step?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's Don Coover. He raises cloned animals in Kansas. He's sold some of their offspring to the market. Just ahead, we want to talk, though, about some of the moral implications of cloning. By the way, today, American scientists report they've derived stem cells from cloned embryos of a rhesus monkey, which shares traits with humans. So does this mean human cloning is next? Is it all just a slippery slope? We just heard Don say he doesn't think what he does is any different than what Mother Nature might do. But we'll ask Don about ranchers' concerns about playing God. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Don Coover, a Texas rancher who raises cloned animals and runs an animal breeding company. Ever since Dolly the sheep was cloned in 1996, ranchers have dreamed of a time when they can make exact copies of their best animals and breed them. That's what Don Coover says he can and has done through cloning cattle. Don, the first cows weren't cloned until 1998. So, first, do you worry that enough time hasn't passed to know the full impact on humans? It's so new. We don't really know what happens when humans eat meat or drink milk from a cloned animal.
The best scientific evidence available, and it's been widely studied in some depth by the government and by companies involved in cloning, by companies involved in production of animals. My limited experience is basically hands-on. I've raised 6 clones. I see absolutely zero difference in those animals.
And then we should say this is the National Academy of Sciences. Their report came out in 2002. They say the same as the FDA, that they felt it was as healthy as mainstream food. You know, but what about...
I mean, I think that if we don't make our decisions based on the available science, then the decisions we're making are capricious.
But a lot of people make their decisions based on something more spiritual. And I want to ask you about that. I want to ask you about that. There are many people who don't like the way animals are, you know, engineered for food anyway. These, you know, vegetarians, they are never going to be interested in cloning. However, even some ranchers, in the Wired article, we read some quotes, had some questions about this idea that they might be playing God. Do you, you know, your thoughts on that?
I think that God gives you the ability to make rational decisions, and hopefully you make those in an ethical and moral manner, to an ethical and moral end. When I made the first full flesh clones, I spoke to several ranchers.
These are clones of a
very famous and very desirable animal. And we made, and it was, as far as I know, it was the first commercially supported cloning attempt, at least in the United States, and I funded it. And we made several copies of this animal. I had talked to several other ranchers about cloning their bulls, and everybody had the same reservations. It was new. They weren't familiar with the technology. They didn't like the idea. But I talked to a guy named Dean Kephart from Canute, Oklahoma, and he said, sure, if you can do that, make me several copies. I'll turn them out, and I won't have to AI with semen. I can just use the genetics from these cloned bulls.
You won't have to artificially inseminate.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I did that. And later I had several of the guys that I'd approached first about cloning their bulls telling me, I certainly wish I'd have done that because we've lost those genetics. I can't get that semen anymore on that bull because he's dead and gone, and I sure wish I had that. One of them told me, he said, if I had only known it was like boiling water. And I said, what do you mean, like boiling water? He said, well, I used to boil water over a stove all the time. And he said, I boiled water over a campfire. And then I bought a microwave oven, and I was apprehensive about the water I boiled in a microwave oven until I realized it doesn't really matter how you make it, it's still hot water. You know, we do embryo transfer and artificial insemination, and I'm actively trying to develop a more efficient way, a more cost-effective way to produce these clones. And I have embryos brought in from, Pennsylvania. They're overnighted to me, and I put them in surrogate mothers or recipient cows and all that. And everybody says, boy, this really looks like it's a lot of fun and a great time. And it is. I mean, that's why I do it. I could do other things. I've done a lot of other things, but this is what I want to do now. You will occasionally have people show up that say, well, you know, you seem like you're so concerned about your animals. And every good rancher or farmer I've ever met has been very concerned about their animals. They're not animal rightists. They're really animal welfareists. There's a huge difference.
Do your animals go to pasture at all?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Every one of them. In fact, this facility I've built to do embryo transfer work, we don't dry lot those animals. I have little 5 and 6 acre traps where they can run around and have fun with all their buddies, and the big cows can get away from the little cows, and the little cows can get away from the big cows, and, you know, everybody can kind of do their thing like they're supposed to do.
Well, you know, there are some where they're just sort of caged.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a very efficient way to do it. But I mean, for what I'm trying to do, I think that cow comfort is a big deal if you're doing embryo production.
I'm wondering, I'm hearing some frustration, maybe even more than that, in your voice. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, you've talked about the government foot dragging, but I'm wondering, too, if that's some frustration at the American public. Michael Pollan's written a lot about this. You know, people are shoveling in their Big Macs and all of this stuff, but they don't want to know how it's made.
It's interesting to me that I see people criticize the industry for trying to apply new and more efficient technologies and at the same time complain about the variation they find in the product and the cost of the product. I've got no problem with people that want to have grass-fed beef because that's an emerging niche market for my industry, or people that want to stay away from anything that smacks of cloning or antibiotics or anything. All those are niche markets, and I think they're all valid and valuable. I've got no problem with them a bit. But I really would like to have people be more comfortable with the idea that this is not a bunch of ranchers out there trying to shovel them something they don't want to eat. I think this is a superior product that they'll find more desirable and more useful and hopefully safer and more advantageous than anything else that's available.
And that you don't think it should be labeled so that they can make that choice, since people are making so many choices.
I think you have to be able to justify a requirement to treat something special. And I don't think you can justify this requirement. I think it would be like me saying, you have to label every animal that was milked by hand as opposed to milked with a machine. Mm-hmm. Because I think those machines may have altered that milk content some way, when the scientific evidence clearly shows that that's not the case. So how can I require somebody to do that when it makes no sense to anybody except my prejudice?
But why wouldn't free-range animals only eating grass, living longer lives, not being sort of a science project, why wouldn't that be the way to go to bring meat to Americans? The only way to go?
Because it's not efficient, it doesn't work in our environment. It would be sort of like me saying, I think everybody should go back to riding horses and park their cars, and it will do so much for the atmosphere. We won't have gas fumes in there. People will get more exercise. The obvious answer to that is you can't get people transported around to where they need to be to do what they need to do and conduct life in today's environment.
Are you saying it would be too expensive?
Yes.
People wouldn't pay for it.
You wouldn't be able to afford it. It wouldn't be the product that people are used to. It's a great idea. And it's kind of romanticized, 100 years out of date, at least, way to produce the food America needs. But it's a short-term, not very sophisticated, unusable solution to a problem that's much deeper and more pervasive.
Don Coover has raised clone cattle and their offspring in Galesburg, Kansas. He also owns SEK Genetics, an animal breeding company, and he's been weighing in on the issue of cloned meat. Don, thanks for coming in to speak with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the hidden cost of the war in Iraq, family members staying home to care for disabled vets, or the lost productivity when a vet can't go back to work. It could all cost trillions. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, how do you unionize home health care workers when their employer is usually a family member? Back after the news, Here and Now. The Service Employees International Union, SEIU, just made another move into the healthcare industry when more than 22,000 personal care attendants, sometimes called home health aides, voted to join the union here in Massachusetts. The sign-up was the result of an alliance with state government, which formed a council of healthcare professionals and healthcare clients positioned to oversee the caregivers. It's modeled after home care commissions in states like California, Oregon, and Michigan, and it's part of SEIU's future goal of organizing hospital workers. But unionizing private workers, who employers are families and whose workplace is in the home with the disabled, the elderly, that raises a lot of questions, and we want to get some answers today from Mike Fadell. He's vice president of 1199 SEIU, the Massachusetts chapter of the Service Employees International Union. Mike, welcome.
Hi.
We're also joined by Liz Casey. She's one of the nine members of the new Massachusetts Quality Home Care Workforce Council. She also has multiple sclerosis and employs personal care attendants, one of whom, Jessica, is sitting with us here in the studio. Liz, welcome to you as well.
Hello.
And Mike, let's start. You know, who are these workers? Distinguish them, for instance, from visiting nurses.
Personal care attendants, or PCAs, are home care workers who work with people with disabilities really across the country.
And they also work with the elderly. They're not trained as nurses. In fact, sometimes perhaps not trained at all, but we should rush to say we consider them saints, those who have had these people work in their homes.
What's unique about the personal care attendant program is that the training is entirely directed by the consumer or the person with disabilities that they are working with.
Well, Liz, let's bring you in because you, as we said, employ aides at home. What are some of the things that you need help with?
Wow, Robin, there's a long list.
Yeah.
Imagine all the things that you do in a day and then imagine somebody doing them for you. So I'll get up, we'll do the bladder and bowel care first. Then toothbrushing, face washing, getting dressed literally one leg at a time. Then we'll do stretching for the legs and the arms and adjusting me in my chair, you know, a little to the right, a little to the left. It is endless,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, we just noticed Jessica, you know, has to help you sip on water because
exactly.
You don't have use of your arms.
Exactly.
So this is the range of the work the personal care attendants do, you know, caring for the elderly and the disabled. But Mike, how does the program work? I mean, these are, here in Massachusetts, let's stay here for a second, these are private, independent workers. They're hired by an individual like Liz or, you know, a family. They become unionized. Who's their shop steward? Who negotiates pay?
This will really be, and is already, a sort of a very different union than what you might traditionally think of. We actually had to pass a law, and the law created a Quality Home Care Council, which is a body that will be charged with giving PCAs the right to collectively bargain to lift their wages and benefits. All the while, the person receiving the care will still retain fully the right to hire, fire, and direct and train the work as they see fit.
But now, we understand, aren't wages, Liz, set by what Medicaid is able to pay? Medicaid is, you know, both state and federal funds.
I think we're going to have to sit down with Medicaid and negotiate for a raise in the pay, but also for sick pay and other benefits.
But do you think you're going to be able to get that? This week there are reports that the Bush administration is planning to cut up to $100 million of Medicaid funds, and you're saying that you're going to negotiate with Medicaid to not only raise wages, but get benefits.
This is a beginning. PCAs and consumers need to know that it's going to take time, it's going to take hard work. In Oregon, they had a real fight with Medicaid about a lot of services that were cut. And it took that kind of fight, and it took some time, but they got what they needed.
What happens when there are problems, Mike? I had a home health aide for my mom when she was becoming elderly and having issues in New York State. And there are always problems. They are saints, but they get sick. They may not be able to come in at the last second. Who's responsible for the home health aide under the structure here in Massachusetts? Is the small commission? Is the union? Is the state? Who's responsible?
What's unique about this program, although there are comparable programs in many other states, is that it's consumer-directed. Sort of the area of interaction between the person with disabilities and the PCA is not an area where there will be union involvement at all. In fact, the legislation creating the Quality Home Care Workforce Council enshrines the consumer rights in that legislation. And so there will be consumers will have the right to hire, fire, and direct the work.
What we're hoping to do with creation of the workforce referral directory is to also have an emergency backup plan. We're looking at the situation in California where they've done this already, and they've done it and revised it so that now they have an agency that is hired to be the backup team. And people actually get incentive pay if they show up within the hour or within 2 hours. They get incentive pay for that. So that type of thing, we need an organized fashion in which to do that.
Yeah, because in New York State, for instance, there are Medicaid-mandated, state-mandated home health aid agencies, and they're the ones who are responsible if at 9 o'clock in the morning there's a problem and you suddenly need another aid. There's an agency responsible for it. Is that something that would be a helpful model?
That is a possibility. The agencies would be something that people would have the option to use. They wouldn't be mandated to use it so that they would have that as a backup plan.
What about strikes, Mike? People think personal care attendants and strike, and it strikes fear in their heart.
This campaign started years ago, and that was naturally a question that came up because that's an association that's out there generally. And so there were commitments made that would never happen, and beyond that, those commitments were enshrined in the legislation that created the Quality Home Care Workforce Council so that PCAs do not have the right to strike.
There's one group that may not be happy with this, though, and that's the nursing home workers.
Right.
Because the cost comparison between keeping someone in the home, even with a unionized aid worker, is far less than a nursing home. What are you going to do for them? Because you're a service union, Mike. And these are people who are seeing their jobs being eliminated. And Liz is nodding yes, if more people are staying at home.
This whole movement to organize PCAs is about lifting up the conditions. And nursing home workers need that same attention. But I think there's been a disproportionate voice for the nursing home industry when it comes to state policy. And I think by organizing the PCA workforce, PCAs will be able to have a voice that starts to catch hold and starts to shift policy more towards home-based care, which is sorely needed.
Mike Fadel, Vice President of 1199 SEIU, that's the Service Employees International Union chapter here in Massachusetts. We also spoke with Liz Casey, who is a member of the new Massachusetts Quality Home Care Workforce Council that will be overseeing the state's over 22,000 personal care attendants, and she also is a consumer of long-term health care herself. Thank you both for your time here today.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, before the hour's up today, don't try this at home, but if you already can drive a nail through your head, Ripley's, believe it or not, wants you. We'll see the world according to the people at Ripley's. You're listening to Here and Now. The first rule of any museum is usually don't touch anything, ever. But students from the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts, recently broke this rule at one of the country's most prestigious fine arts museums. Here now, intern Jill Ryan brings us the story.
It's a buzzing afternoon at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Taxis queue in the driveway, students on field trips clog the entrance, and on the second floor, outside the Chinese Furniture Gallery, teenagers wearing white gloves grasp at one of two stone lion statues guarding the entrance.
So it's a small little statue of a lion. You have your hand on his nose and one hand on the back legs, okay?
Deanna, a student from Perkins School for the Blind, feels inside the lion's open mouth as museum volunteer Phyllis Robbins guides her hand.
What do you think this is?
The mouth.
The mouth? And can you feel? What's in the mouth?
Teeth.
Of course. Wonderful.
Deanna is one of five Perkins students visiting the museum today. All have significant difficulties seeing, so much so that a trip to an art gallery would normally involve a whole lot of listening. And, says Perkins School art teacher Terry Werner,
that's boring. I mean, think about it. Standing around for an hour and a half listening to somebody talk when you're a teenager, you know, you don't even do that with your friends.
So Werner met with members of the MFA's program for blind visitors called Feeling for Form, and together they laid out a plan to get students involved.
This feels shorter.
It is shorter.
Min is a Perkins student. She runs her hands over limestone-carved stools set up in a mock Chinese garden. Her guide is Veronica Toro Ruiz.
Looks like a drum.
They're like drums, exactly. That's what it is.
These museum visits inspired students to create their own works, now on display on the ground floor of the museum. There's a styrofoam board mini cutout of a red electric guitar, a handful of colorful clay animal masks, and a painting of a white dog bounding by a large red barn. Min and Mike are students with art on display.
Where are you, Mike?
I'm right here.
I'll take your wrist, buddy.
Min guides Mike's hand to her piece hanging on the wall. It's a frisbee-sized plaster mold of an angel with a thin white body, oval pink face, and textured round yellow wings. Min created it after visiting the Italian sculpture exhibit.
What did you actually use on it? I think it's cool.
I used the spoon for the wings.
Yeah. What kind of spoon did you use?
Plastic.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Mike's mask hangs next to Min's angel. He created it after visiting the African exhibit.
Mike.
Yes.
Does this one have a beard on it?
No. That's all the fur that you see. It's a cat. That's what it is.
But with Mike's piece, there are bumps and waves in the clay that Perkins School art teacher Terry Werner says are invisible to the naked eye.
And his mask is kind of a camouflage, black and white. If you touch it, you can see all the three-dimensional things on it. But just to look at it, you can't experience it at all.
Perkins student Miranda also focused on details of texture. She created a dog mask after visiting a statue of Cerberus, the underworld's mythical three-headed guard dog.
I really had to picture, okay, what do my dog's ears feel like? Or what did the face feel like on the piece of artwork that I felt? So, you know, really trying to capture that image in your head and trying to display it in your own artwork.
Miranda says this process of touching and imagining sets a blind artist's work apart from that of a sighted person.
So I think someone who is sighted might do as equally well, but tactilely, they maybe might not pay as much attention to detail.
It's the textural details of students' art that tempt even the non-blind to touch the masks, to feel the markings, the etches, the undulations in the clay. And as visitors touch and see students' art, Miranda hopes the pieces do more than just hang on the wall.
We get the chance to look at some wonderful artwork and be inspired. So my hope is that someone, you know, in passing will look at ours and it'll inspire them to create something of their own.
That visit by the Perkins School of the Blind to Boston's Museum of Fine Arts was brought to us by Here and Now intern Jill Ryan. Coming up, the Ripley Empire, Here and Now. Believe it or not, that phrase was coined by Robert Ripley in 1918. He scrawled the words above a series of newspaper sketches he'd done of somewhat dubious sporting achievements, a man running 100 yards backwards in 14 seconds, another hopping 100 yards in 11 seconds. His original title for the sketches was Champs and Chumps, but the cartoons under the new phrase, Believe It or Not, made Robert Ripley an overnight sensation. His legacy today is an entertainment franchise that features museums, podcasts, and books, all chronicling the unbelievable stories and bizarre feats, and sometimes feet to ease, of the most astonishing people, places, and creatures. Two of the new books are Ripley's Believe It or Not, The Remarkable Revealed, and Ripley's Search for the Shrunken Heads and Other Curiosities. Tim O'Brien is Vice President of Publishing and Entertainment for Ripley's and aficionado of all things Ripley. He joins us from Nashville. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
What's the appeal? You know, beyond, I'm looking through one of the books, The Poor Kitten with Two Faces, or The Horse Who Loves to Paint, or The Woman Who Got Her Suitcase Back 44 Years After She Lost It. You know, why has it endured?
Curiosity, I think, is the one word. Curiosity, awareness of the odd, the weirdness, the non-mainstream. I think you could put all that in together into a package, and that's a Ripley appeal of today, as it was in 1918.
You know, I'm thinking of some of the things just breezing through, particularly the Ripley's Believe It or Not, The Remarkable Revealed. You know, there's the little baby with three arms, or the man born with three legs, or the woman who had two wombs and delivered a baby from each one. You'd think, with political correctness, that some of these things that are exhibited as sort of, you know, oddities when they're, you know, deformities, you'd think that those would be forbidden now, but it doesn't seem as if they are.
Well, the modern line has been drawn where you don't exhibit them in person, but it's definitely all right to show their picture.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about the history. Who is Robert Ripley? A fascinating character. We know he grew up in California. Tell us more about him.
At 14 years of age, he went up to San Francisco and worked as an illustrator for the newspaper. And through his everyday work, he ran into Jack London. And he became a literary friend of Jack London. And at one point, London said, you know, Rip, you can't make it big in San Francisco there. You've got two dreams. You want to play professional baseball, and you want to make it big in illustration. There's only one place to be, and that's in New York.
No.
So in late 1913, Rip climbed on board a train at 23 years of age and went to New York. And in 1914, he tried out for the New York Giants and actually made the team. He was a professional baseball player. His first game, he broke an arm. And it went back to the proverbial drawing board. So right. In 1918, he created Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Very interesting character. Wore knee-length knickers and argyle socks, whether it was hot or cold. Was afraid of the telephone, thought it would electrocute him. Became a ladies' man after his first marriage failed. By the way, his work, we should say, the Ripley's, is not to be confused with the Guinness Book of World Records. That's all documented. How much of Ripley's should we believe? How much was true?
100%.
Yeah.
People tried through the years to prove him wrong, and only on a couple occasions were they able to do so. He, right from the very beginning, felt that truth was much stranger than fiction and much more fun to write about. And that's where he went. And we, as caretakers of his brand today, feel the same way.
He was a journalist. I mean, a first-rate one. He covered the Antwerp Olympics and then began taking pictures of things that fascinated him from 201 countries. But then let's get to the exhibit part, because he did open a number of museums, if you will. He called them auditoriums, ODD, where he displayed some of the things he collected. That would probably be a little more controversial today, but people love them.
Oh, in 1933, he opened his first auditorium in Chicago at the World's Fair. And you know, he started building this huge collection because people thought he was a liar. Yeah, sure, you brought back a shrunken head picture. Well, where's a real shrunken head? Nobody could shrink a head that small. And things like that. So he had to start bringing things back from his travels just to prove that he wasn't a liar. And in 1933, at the first auditorium, they had to have doctors and nurses on hand for all the people who fainted
right. When
they saw this stuff.
100 people every day, so he had to install beds for them to recover on. That was a big thing, to go and faint
yeah. At
the show. He also had a radio show. We heard a little bit. Let's hear a little more. This is from January 5th, 1938 on NBC.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've just presented a broadcast from the burning mine under the town of New Straitsville, Ohio, which has been burning for 54 years and which has destroyed more than $50 million worth of coal, and unless these men are successful, it may burn forever. Believe it or not.
There's a crazy novelty tune creeping in the country, and lovely Linda Lee goes slightly gaga with Dipsy Doodle.
The Dipsy Doodle's the thing to beware. The Dipsy Doodle will get in your hair. And if it gets you, it couldn't be worse. The things you say will come out in reverse, like you love I and me loves you. That's the way the Dipsy Doodle works. The Dipsy Doodle is easy to find. It's almost always in back of your mind. You never know it until it's too late. And then you're in such a terrible state, like the moon jumps over the cow. Hey, Dipsy.
He also did a television show. In fact, he died. He collapsed on the set, didn't he, in 1949?
He did. He was one of the first people to have a regularly scheduled television show. And each one of his shows was a theme. And on his 13th show in 1949, the theme was death rituals in the various cultures around the world. And he was actually standing there interviewing the man who developed taps for the military funerals. The guy was playing taps. Ripley dropped, and he never regained consciousness. And that was on live TV, and he died the next day.
Believe it or not.
What a way to go,
believe
huh?
Believe it or not. Well, now we have the two new books. The first, Ripley's Believe It or Not, The Remarkable Revealed. And, oh, look, there's someone who can swallow their tongue, or there's other contortionists, or bizarre facts, or, oh, look, there's a guy kissing a poisonous snake. But the second book is also fascinating. It's called Ripley's Search for the Shrunken Heads and Other Curiosities, and it's sort of laid out as his sort of travel notebook with pop-up things, and all, here's a page where we actually see a drawing of some sort of shrunken head, but there's hair coming off it that you can really feel, children can. What was the purpose of this book?
It's a very interactive book, first of all, and it's a great way to learn because Ripley himself said the best way to learn is through discovery. And as you know, these little things that you can lift up and look under, and the whole book is a sense of discovery. But everything's been written about Ripley has been written by other people, basically. And this entire book is based on his own words,
right.
Are his own words. And that's kind of cool, reading his diary as he's going into Ecuador to look for the Jivaro Indian tribe's shrunken heads. And you can read excerpts from his own diary in his own words and see the little doodles that he made on the side of his journal.
Right.
It's very firsthand.
There's his cartoons, doodles. There's pockets, little doors, pouches, envelopes, tickets, menus, newspaper, magazine clippings. And, oh, look, there's a little fun fact. A Peruvian Jose Fernandez could drive a 20-penny nail into his head up to the hilt through his nose.
Believe it or not.
Tim O'Brien, Vice President of Publishing and Entertainment for Ripley's Believe It or Not. Tim, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.